Always record, episode 133.
Do you know who Roman really is?
What do you mean, honey?
He's Adrian Marcato's son.
What?
Come here. I'm going to show you something. Roman Castevet is Stephen Marcato, rearranged. It's from Hutch. Look here. There he is when he was 13. See the eyes?
Coincidence.
In the same house? And look here. Soon after that, in August 1886, his son Stephen was born. 1886, got it? That makes him 79 now. No coincidence.
I guess not.
So, there was something I wanted to bring up with you. At my job, I have this cook who's from Hawaii, and he told me this story the other day, which I just thought you might find interesting from a comparative mythology point of view. He was talking about this, essentially this ritual that they do, and he was talking about if you have, like, basically, like, negative thoughts or things troubling you, that you sit on the beach, and he's like, you're supposed to be nude, and you take these leaves of this particular plant, and you're supposed to fashion a wreath out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And...
or a laurel.
Right. Laurel and Hardy.
Right.
And you put it on your head, and then you wait for the sun to rise. And he's like, and then you step out into the ocean, and you don't swim. You just have to keep walking and walking and walking into the water and basically sink. And you keep walking until the wreath or laurel rises off your head and floats into the water.
Right. It's the same thing that they do in Shivaratri with roses.
Gotcha. So, and you know, he kept stressing. He's like, but what you have to do is you have to really believe, and you have to put every ounce into this thing. And that, he's like, if you even leave one little nugget of a thought, it'll fester and grow right back.
Mm-hmm.
And all I could think of was the idea of the scapegoat.
Mm-hmm.
Right, this idea of, you know, you were talking about, you put your ailments into the goat and you push the goat off the cliff.
Right, which I also found out could be there's different ways to interpret the meaning of the text when it's, because the word for cliff, I guess, is the same word for something else. So it's open to debate, but the point is that they kill the fucking goat, and that it all is about the string and whether or not the string will turn white that's on the temple, which is the other half of the string that's on the goat. And then if the string turns white, then your sins have been taken away, which is the exact same thing you see with a yugya. So if you do a yugya, you're literally tying a red string around your arm. And when the string turns white, it's supposed to have taken in some scars or the latent tendencies with the fire. So every time you're throwing seeds into this fire that's on top of a mandala, that you're literally burning, saying Om Swaha, so you're saying to the primordial fire, to the primordial vibration, you know, you're releasing your samskaras, but they have the same meaning there with the red turning white. And so then that becomes a Kabbalistic thing too, because you have the milk is the sweetened judgments. So it's chesed acting on gevurah. So as gevurah just be blood, but the blood basically turns to milk. So it's kind of interesting.
Shit, sorry, I was muted. Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, that, and that's just it. It's like, so you're saying that there's what's the other version of this that you're saying that's done with roses? I mean.
Oh yeah, so Shivaratri, you'd be traditionally you're up all night on Shivaratri singing and doing, taking weed traditionally or whatever, I guess it's a soma way back when, right? And then in the morning, after you've been up all night, then you have four people with a pallet that you're carrying, like they do in a marriage, where you're carrying this big thing and it's got a pile of flowers on it. And so you walk that into like the Ganga traditionally, or a lake, in India they do this, and you go underneath the water, and then it's like a baptism too, but you're taking it to the level of the water, so you're going below, and then you come up from under the flowers, so you're like boo burst through the flowers, it's kind of a it's a tradition, but it's definitely symbolically resonant with what you're talking about. I mean, it immediately comes to mind. So.
Yeah, absolutely. It's I don't know, just a really really interesting sort of thought process of as yeah, I could take this 50 different directions, but I just wanted to sort of share that with you. So it's interesting that that you're aware of other versions of it. In Golden Bough, there's an interesting little section where he talks about how they used to kill the kings, and basically the kings catch on. They're like, wait a second, this sucks. I don't want to fucking die. So they then basically get one of their advisors or one of their whatever that they bestow them with the great honor and ability of taking this on for them. So now you don't have to kill the king, you can kill the king's substitute or proxy.
Kill the messenger.
Yeah, precisely. So,
Which is a that was a multi-layered joke, because Jesus himself claims to be the messenger of the one who will come, who is the Son of Man, who is actually royalty. And so he literally is a sacrifice who's a messenger for the one who is the Messiah. And so the classic argument nowadays, and it's not like Joseph Atwell was the first person to propose this. He just popularized it. But this idea that Titus Caesar is actually the symbolism. Everything that Jesus says the Son of Man will do is accomplished by Titus Caesar. And so that's been acknowledged for a long time. Just it's very controversial in the same way that the Golden Bough points out all kinds of things that were. Frazier wasn't the first person to pick up on in terms of Christianity, but he definitely laid it out in a way that hadn't been laid out before, as far as I know. But they're also like, I guess with Cambridge, it was kind of like they didn't really care or think much about the rest of the world. It's an intellectual circle. They're kind of like presenting their own. I guess beyond the Golden Bough, they've all, that particular university has always been kind of like on its own tip, like to unto itself, it's only after the fact, when they published it, that it was like, whoa, 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 whoa. And so, yeah, that was the thing, is that copy that Stanley Kubrick gave the head of Warner Brothers, or that set of volumes, that was, that was the version, I guess, that had the whole Christianity thing, which not until recently has that finally been published. It's like that wasn't that Christianity stuff wasn't available in the Golden Bough. And most copies that you find will just, I mean, they'll skip 10,000 pages, but they'll skip that part too,
Right. Well, it was basically censored, for lack of a better term, because it's saying you can't call this mythology. You can't compare it to this other stuff. It was blasphemous, quote unquote.
Right. Even though it's totally mythology. So, I mean, whichever way, like that's the Old Testament of mythology too. You're poetically communicating. So there's reality, there's things that are happening, and then there's a poetic songs about what's happening that are mythologized. So the same way, it's like Caesar wasn't a god, but like they made him into a god. I mean, it's obvious, I mean, we got August, right? I mean, it just came out of August before September, you know, but that's for Augustus Caesar, right? So, and then which day?
October is Octavius, right?
Is that right? Yeah, okay. So that's the thing, is that the
July is
amongst the gods. But yeah, I mean, it's just that's the recognition that we were doing the same thing with our presidents, but we're not. We don't think that we relate to them that way, but there's implications that we do. So that's crazy. And our star system in general. I mean, that's just the way we imbue people. We give them a godlike kind of deal, you know. And it's like Jay Kotza would point out, you know, the as above, so below, and the stars up there, and then the stars down here. But it's like we make these stars through the, you know, power of our belief or whatever, or our unconsciousness, really. Because it's I think it imbues something to be less conscious of it. I think it gives it more of a force, actually, because then it becomes uncanny, because to have certain people wear something or relating to it in a certain way and then have the majority relating to it differently kind of sets up a an energetic, I guess, or it sets up a dynamic that then can that can play out in ways that are kind of unthinkable, but yet still manifest somehow.
Did you happen to read Zenora's latest blog post? Marshall McLuhan, Moonchild, Part 2.
Oh, was it Marshall McLuhan, Moonchild, Part 2 that I read? I don't know. I did read a recent thing. I mean, it was like a month ago, I guess. Are you talking about like a month ago, or did he do another one?
He just did something a few days ago.
Oh, no, I haven't read that.
Yeah, he did a part two. Okay, I'm just going to read a little bit. There was something before this, but it's going to take me too long to find it all. The globalized electronic media ecology is only potentially the contemporary manifestation of the mystical body of Christ. And there's a part where he explains how basically media is an extension of man and man's aspirations, then this is basically everything that we're creating is a manifestation of the mystical body of Christ, right? But then he goes to this thing that makes this sort of disclaimer or caveat that it's only potentially that.
Sure. It's like currency.
Right. So it says, more than likely, however, is the exact opposite of this. It is a simulacra, a counterfeit. In a 1969 letter to Jacques Martin, this contrary view is expressed. Quote, whereas the Renaissance print-oriented individual thought of himself as a fragmented entity, the electronic-oriented person thinks of himself as tribally inclusive of all mankind. Electronic information environments being utterly ethereal fosters the illusion of a world as a spiritual substance. It is now a reasonable facsimile of the mystical body, a blatant manifestation of the Antichrist. After all, the prince of this world is a very great electric engineer. And again, in a 1969 letter about Maritain's work, he repeats this assertion. Quote, have just read Maritain's The Peasant of Garonne, 100% right as far as he goes. He is totally ignorant of the new electric environment as creating the world before which misguided Christians kneel. This strictly Luciferian product is ethereal and a highly plausible mock-up of the mystical body. There's no harm in reminding ourselves from time to time that the prince of this world is a great PR man, a great salesman of new hardware and software, a great electrical engineer, and a great master of the media. It is his masterstroke to be not only environmental but invisible, for the environment is invincibly persuasive when ignored.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there was something really weird that I was coming across, because, you know, I've been waiting a year to translate this text that I was talking about before from the Zohar with 9/11. And so we finally got to it, and we're on the commentary right now, and it's unbelievable, you know. But there's this idea that's getting proposed all over the place in other parts of the Zohar, where you have this green line that spirals around the world, that is basically it's almost like the fall is related to like a virus or something, and because it changes the perception. So there's like, you know, with knowledge comes a different vision. And so you basically create a disequilibrium in order to reach a new equilibrium. But the line that gets wrapped around the earth, that's, it seems to be speaking to like the, maybe it's the origin of the Orphic egg, I was thinking, because like the serpent around the egg, very similar description, because it's like this green spiral. And so, and then it's relating it to the fall. So I'm like, oh yeah, the serpent of the fall. So I think that that's a very plausible idea, and that what's being born is the consciousness within the thing, right? So it's metaphorical or whatever. But the thing is that it's relating that line to the 70 princes, which correspond to 70 quadrants around the earth, who are basically holding things on a certain level. So they're like, you know, instead of having, you know, transcendence or whatever, you know, they're keeping things in a certain way. But basically they have it like, when this event happens with these three strongholds collapsing on 9/11, it's like after that, there's a interval of time where this fixed star basically comes and scatters all the other stars, which are the 70 princes. So they have their control, relative control, over the earth. And so they're influencing. So they're not actually it's kind of weird. It's like just same thing like with astrology, where you have this notion of influence. It's not saying that this is determinism. It's not necessitating that there's no free will or whatever necessarily. It's just that there's these parameters that are set up, that there are these guidelines, and people generally don't go beyond the guidelines, and that those are set up by these kind of like supernal rulers or whatever, and that those rulers are influencing the rulers of the planet too as a thing. So it's like they're like intelligences or whatever that are but what's weird is that the way that it was phrasing it, me and Baruch can't figure it out, because it's like it's saying it's either +2 or -2. It's talking about the number of these quadrants in this particular place. So you're like 68 or 72, which is really interesting, because did the fucking Tenet come out in 72? I think that's what it was. I was like, oh, weird. Rosemary's Baby came out in 68 and the Tenet came out in 72, which are like, you know, really complimentary or whatever. But if I recall correctly, that's the way it was. But anyways, point being, 72 is obviously significant, as it's the demonstrable value of, there's the 72 names of God, right? So then they're all under that umbrella. But where was I going to go with this? Oh yeah, just that notion of the influence and the dispersion of the influence, and specifically in relationship to Sirius at this time and all this stuff, and the idea of a superstar that's greater than the other stars, and how that could translate to, you're like, oh, you got these basically influencing stars, and you have a star system, and it's just kind of like set up this mold for a narrative for people to relate to. And it's like the primary tool for media to manipulate is through a narrative. I mean, that's like, and it's weird because it goes even beyond like conscious manipulation. You're like, I mean, I don't know, but like, isn't it kind of weird that on September 11th of this year, lightning struck the mosque in Mecca? You know what I mean? It's like, that's like, I mean, Jason was able to call that before it happened. Jason was able to prophesy it because he can see the fucking narrative and the symbols, and it's just so direct. And so it's no surprise. You're like, oh, the lightning flash created weird. It's just, it becomes less surprising when you follow the narrative for a while. You know what I mean? It's like,
well, that's just it. So if everything's, you know, if this goes back to the idea of when we talk about predicting things, as well as this idea of like the sort of anniversary complex, where, okay, this happens on such and such day, where it's almost like, well, of course it does, right? But then are we reinforcing that? I saw Joanna Wensky sort of commenting on, like, are we reinforcing such a thing? Are we putting that into our consciousness and making that somehow more true, or, you know, sort of manifesting it ourselves? And I know even, Chris Knowles, he said a few years ago, he's like, he refused to comment on sort of esoteric media anymore because he felt almost like he was aiding it, or, you know, he couldn't figure out if he was in some way promoting something that he wasn't necessarily trying to.
I have an argument for that.
Sure.
Which is that, how long have we been fucking here on this kind of pyramid schema? And how long has it been that the people who are generally relating to this stuff are people who are, I think that there's just a real, like, the whole, like, kill all the witches and whatever religion was there that was removed, that's, you know, probably a goddess religion or whatever, you know, like, whatever, if they're stamping it out or they're putting a hold on it, you can bet that there's something to it. I just feel that there's, like, almost like no way around, only through kind of thing. It's like you can't, I mean, what are your options? But to,
I get that completely. Yeah.
It's like you got to acknowledge if the thing is there anyway, and you're like, oh, are we imbuing it? But like in the whole of history, that hasn't been like, we've seen what happens when we aren't aware of these levels of things. We have yet to see what happens when the populace is completely in a way.
Like, that's a great point. Yeah.
And like with the Bible, it's like people weren't even allowed to read the Bible until very recently. I mean, just in the overarching timeline, it's a recent phenomenon for people to be able to read the Bible who are considered regular citizens. And pagan is synonymous with citizen from its roots. And there's a reason for that. And so it's like,
are you talking about it being censored, or are you talking about just literacy in general?
Oh, no, I was saying that the word pagan means civilian.
When you said people weren't able to read the Bible, I'm saying, are you talking about...
Oh, it was censored, and they didn't have it available. They had preachers telling them what it said, or ministers telling them what it said, and then even those ministers oftentimes weren't, like, reading it in its original writing and looking, you know what I mean? Like, it wasn't truly scholarly. So it's like, it's a recent phenomenon that we're even able to do this. And that was the big point with, like, you know, what Alwell's presenting, which he's popularizing. It was as soon as people were able to take a scholarly view that they were allowed to look at the Bible objectively, that they noticed the Josephus Flavius connection. And so, I mean, it's just, it was an inevitable thing. It's just, and so that's why I look at that and I'm like, oh, I could almost, like, I can have some sympathy for Bernays, not completely, but just on a certain level, just like, oh my God, they're that gullible. Oh my God, they just fell for that. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, it can't be that easy, can it? Oh, what do you know it is? And like, I wonder with Josephus if it's like, I mean, he's still a Jew. Like, you know, the way that he gets presented, you know, is, you know, especially in Gomorrah or something, they're like, you know, he's an evil son of a bitch or whatever. But it's like, it seems like from his position, I wonder if he was just like, oh, come on, this isn't going to take them that long to figure out what's being done here. Because it's like, he has it all right there. You can see the jokes. You can see the humor. He's not just the joke, but like the whole fucking thing, like. From his perspective, it seems like he included enough there that it would probably be almost inconceivable that you could go another 2,000 years without people picking up on the thing. And so I was saying, like, you know, because of the format in which it's written and because of the things that it connects to in terms of the scapegoat and the obvious things that it's taking from, those are things that Jews didn't take seriously. And so it's like, well, if he's taking this one aspect and connecting it to this prophecy in Isaiah, wouldn't it seem like people, like, if you were, you know, like, because that's the whole point, is that they're trying to get the people to worship Caesar as God, and they're refusing. Oh, so we'll do it in a manipulative way. But I could almost imagine how, from Josephus's perspective, it probably was unfathomable that everyone would actually buy into this to this degree because of all these blatant jokes on their own religion. So, like, it's almost like he... probably, like, because I imagine he would have to have rationalized it somehow, and if he was going to, it'd probably be that. He's like, oh, I have to write this thing. Oh, why not just fucking, you know, include all the things that we don't take seriously and make them like, you know, well,
how much do you factor into that, like, Rome's sort of forced conversion to Christianity, though?
That's exactly it. He was forced to convert and bow before Caesar. The story goes is that they're all in a line, and all these people, you know, rebels, and they shot. He chose to stand at the end of the line. So they shoot every, or not shoot, didn't have guns, but you know what I'm saying. They kill everybody in line, and they get to him, and he's like, "Hail Caesar," you know. And so, but it's just the whole point that they destroyed every piece of literature from that area in that era of Judea, and then it's like the one surviving text comes from Josephus. And then when you do a cross analysis between War of the Jews and Antiquities of the Jews and the gospel, you find just like uncanny fucking parallels all over the place. And so it's suggestive that probability theory, that was the argument of Joseph Atwill, that like probabilistically this shouldn't just happen on its own. It suggests intent on the part of whoever, and we're suspecting Josephus because he wrote the fucking, the only other person to have work survive from that area, and that area is from a Roman botanist. And the stuff that was hidden off in caves and shit, you know. In other words, what was like allowed. And so it's like, if the Romans are the ones perpetuating this religion in the first place, the gospel specifically, then why would they do that if it was opposed to their whole state? And so it seems like it's kind of a manipulation. But I'm like wondering from the perspective of a Jew who surrendered, if he was actually like, oh, well, I'll just encode it in all these different ways so that opening it up for people to look beyond it, he probably had more hope in the intelligence of people. I mean, I don't know. This is total speculation. I really don't know with this one, but that's the direction I speculated. I'm like, you know, he probably didn't think it would last 2,000 plus years before people got the humor of certain things, like the scapegoat. Because, like, the text that I looked at with Baruch, you know, it's, like, about the scapegoat, whenever that would come up, it was, like, there was jokes around it. Like, it wasn't taken seriously. I'm sure some people took it seriously, but it wasn't, like, and it wasn't, like, a big thing in Judaism or anything. It's a big thing in Christianity. It's the whole point of the whole thing. But it wasn't connected to the Messiah, traditionally. Like, that's something that happened with the Christians. They just took this one ritualistic aspect, or this one phenomenon in Judaism, and then they connected it with this prophecy, and then they have the prophecy happen, you know, over 2,000 years before they're waiting for it to take place. And so that's, you know, kind of a weird move, because you're like, no, this is supposed to happen in the far distant future. And it's like, no, this is already, not only is it's already happened, all right, your savior already came, so, you know, you got to deal with that now. Yeah.
So you've been mentioning Atwill a lot lately. So this is all based on this was sort of reinvigorated for you as the interview with Freeman.
Yeah. Well, no. I just it's just been. I mean, that's like, if I'm going to talk about the gospel, that's like, at this point, is something that's really worth mentioning, because it ties in really directly with a lot of the things that I'm struggling to understand in terms of like taking two things and putting them together, whether it be something that holds a lot of resonance, and to see an ancient example, not ancient, but an older example of that phenomenon occurring in that way. Like, I relate to War of the Jews and Antiquities of the Jews aligning with the gospel in a very similar way that I would Dark Side of the Moon and The Wizard of Oz. And so it's because it has one meaning on its own. Each thing has its own meaning on its own, which is, both of those are very rich, but you put them together and then all these other considerations emerge from that synthesis. So it's like a third thing is born out of the two things. And absolutely, so it's almost as if they're having sex in a way. And that was what I took from the Melancholia thing, because there's a quote. I don't know if I ever read that to you, but here, let me just, if you go to melancholia.com, or I don't know if it's just .com. Let me see what it actually is. There's like the official Melancholia website. There's a director's statement and I thought it was really poignant. Hold on, just taking it. But basically, that notion that you have, I don't want to tell you until I find it, because I won't do it justice. Okay, so director's statement for Melancholia. So first of all, the pitch is a beautiful movie about the end of the world. It was like waking from a dream. My producer showed me a suggestion for a poster. "What is that?" I ask. "It's the film you've made," she replies. "I hope not," I stammer. "Trailers are shown, stills. It looks like shit." I'm shaken. "Don't get me wrong. I've worked on the film for 2 years with great pleasure, but perhaps I've deceived myself, let myself be tempted. Not that anyone has done anything wrong. On the contrary, everybody has worked loyally and with talent towards the goal defined by me alone. But when my producer presents me with the cold facts, a shiver runs down my spine. This is cream on cream, a woman's film. I feel ready to reject the film like a wrongly transplanted organ. But what was it I wanted? With a state of mind as my starting point, I desired to drive headlong into the abyss of German romanticism, Wagner in spades, that much I know. But is that not just another way of expressing defeat? Defeat to the lowest cinematic common denominators? Romance is abused in all sorts of endlessly dull ways in mainstream products. And then, I must admit, I have had happy love relationships with romantic cinema, to name the obvious, Visconti. Which, by the way, Visconti's The Stranger is highly recommended. I didn't know that they could do the book so well. Anyways, Camus, you know. German romance that leaves you breathless. But in Visconti, there was always something to elevate matters beyond the trivial. Elevate it to masterpieces. I am confused now and feel guilty. What have I done? Is it Exit Trier? I cling to the hope that there may be a bone splinter amid all the cream in May, after all, crack a fragile tooth. I close my eyes in hope. So, considering the implications of what he's actually saying here, he's basically saying, I've made a woman's film. So the film itself has a woman quality, you know. And then what he's saying is that, is there something hidden that can elevate it to a masterpiece, is literally what he says. And so when he then goes on to say, I hope there may be a bone splitter in all the cream he's referring to as the feminine. So it's something that can crack a fragile tooth is something masculine. So he's literally saying, here's my feminine film. Is there a masculine counterpart to make it into something else? So he closes his eyes in hope for something unknown. I just felt like that was a fascinating director's statement.
Sure, I mean, but also, you know, is that even in itself, like, that's somewhat sexist as well to even, you know.
The point is that it's like he felt. Well, he says all kinds of things that people find offensive, but there's deeper meanings in, and so. I was like, the way he presented it, I almost felt like it was like an excuse to like, how, if I'm making a director's statement, how can I kind of, you know, communicate this point that it's that this is a female and that there's a male. So if you're looking for a way to articulate that, you know, and he's basically acknowledging that the film isn't complete. So he's like, this film I made is not its full potential. And so he's like, and he wants to tell you that it's a woman, and where's the man? And so what I'm proposing is that the Smashing Pumpkins, Melancholia and the Infinite Sadness, is the masculine, and that the film Melancholia is the feminine. And so to bring the two together is literally like they're having sex, and it's all relating to the alchemical idea of Melancholia 1, presented in Melancholia 1, which is referenced directly in the film and album. And so, because you're dealing with alchemy and the alchemical wedding. So literally what he's talking about there is the alchemical wedding. He's like, it's an invitation for the meaning of Melancholia in the first place. And so, yeah, or also this idea that it's like the planet itself is like, it's like you'll be destroyed in the act, but then something else will come of it that's beyond your fathoming. Like, in order to create, you have to destroy. So it's creation, destruction is the theme. You have to destroy the old to get to the new. So I don't know. I don't know. Do you kind of get why I would find that interesting?
Of course, I get why you'd find it interesting. No, of course I would understand why you'd find it interesting. I guess, my point about the, you know, essentially sexist nature of it, is so if it's a sort of a secret joke, then,
you know, disregard that, obviously. But to say it's almost like, right, so the implication isn't necessarily that he wants it to be a masculine film. He wants it to be complete. He's not saying, I want to throw all the cream out. He's just hoping there's something else in there.
Right. And I think it's a joke that he's saying, he's closing eyes and hoping that something will show up. He already fucking knows that there's something. He's just like, nudge, 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 not as good as a wink. There's something in there. Hey, pay attention. That will transform the film. And that's what I feel I've found. But I don't know. It could be crazy. Does that make me crazy?
So you've never heard back, right, from...
I never sent him anything. I was going to send him the whole... I was going to send him art. Is that what you're referring to?
I thought you were composing a letter to say, hey, did you do this? I think I found it.
What I was going to do is I was going to send him, actually, a G. Clay that was actually like 6 feet tall. And along with a little message that had an image of the planet from Melancholia with the hanger thing, you know, the metal device that they're looking at to tell the size of it.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Because there's this very poignant scene where when she's holding it up and it says, to the eye of the jackal, I say kaboom. And then it, like, it happens to be right when she's looking at through the thing at night, you know. And I just wanted to, like, make a little card with that image on it and write that there with it. Because instead of asking or saying anything, in the rare chance that it was actually an intentional deal, then to see that would say it all. It was like, it implies that I figured out the timing, because the only way I would know that is if I was correct, you know?
Got you.
So I want to just imply it. That was just, you know, I was thinking about it from my perspective. I was like, if I was like a director who went to that much trouble to do this thing, or at least have the intention to do like a working around it, if somebody sent me the thing, I would rather not, like, I wouldn't want a letter that feels like the fucking paparazzi, like, questioning, like, did you do this? You know, like, I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to be that fan, because that's not me anyway. I would more like to, like, insinuate something. And if I'm right, on the off chance that I am right, then that would be so much cooler, you know, because it would trip him out. He'd be like, what? What the fuck? You know?
Right. How the fuck did this guy?
Right. So yeah, but I've put that one off. I put a lot of things in my life off, you know. A lot of little things that I'd like to do, and sending Lars von Trier some of my artwork is one of them. I mean, to send something to Denmark or whatever, I forget where he is. But yeah. Yeah. By the way, dude, something really cool happened. I mean, this isn't, I don't know, I guess everything is sync, but I got a phone call from my cousin the other day telling me that he would help me pay for a ticket to go to Sweden and take care of me when I'm there. And so he wanted me to come right away, but I was thinking more like springtime. So I might go to Sweden for like a month in the spring maybe.
And he lives there, or she lives mm-hmm. there?
Yeah, my cousin, he lives in Stockholm.
Gotcha, okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, well, how was, may I ask, how was life treating you in your new residence and such?
Oh, well, I mean, it's new. I mean, I've been in this spot for a year. I'm in the same spot. We had some challenges or kind of threats to things, but it looks like, for the time being at least, everything's okay. So, I love my house, dude. It's incredible.
Gotcha. So it's not like you'd try, you know, it's not like, oh, I want to get away to Sweden. It's just like, Why the fuck wouldn't you go to sleep?
Put that on the table, yeah.
Right. Why wouldn't
I? I was like, okay. Yeah, I mean, I love Sweden. I'd love to go back to Sweden. It's a beautiful, amazing place. And last time I went was in winter, so I was like, if I go, I'd like to plan it for the spring. You know, but who knows how things will play out. But, yeah, just to get that offered to have help with the ticket and then to be taken care of when I'm there is pretty fucking cool, you know. So, yeah, might do that. Anyways.
All right, so let me ask you something else here.
I noticed you liked the video I put up on Facebook, this recent Synchronize.
Yeah.
But I didn't hear, you know, sort of no comment, just a like. I'm just curious, when I put up the sample of that little excerpt, I know you were saying, which I understood you didn't want me focusing on, hey, I'm dating this girl, and I get to, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Relationship stuff, yeah.
Right. But I was able to get all that out of there.
Yeah, you did a good job. It was great. I liked it. I was just so, and it's, you're waiting for the next one to mention the weirdness around Michael Brown, the Ferguson?
I think I'm waiting for episode 8.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just applicable in terms of the fucking, we're going on and on about black and white and the whole zebra thing and all this stuff, and it's like, whoa, that's like, you know, and Helter Skelter, and what are the implications? And Helter Skelter means confusion. And so I look at that whole thing, and I'm like, that is a confusing situation, you know? Feels like there's a class war, and that we're being kind of herded to relate to the class war like it's a racism thing. I'm not denying racism. Racism is real. It exists, and it seems like, but the roots of racism are in class. And so when we brought the slaves over in the first place, that was a class act, you know what I mean? Like, that was people who wanted something to gain financially by using people for their, you know, like, it's always been a class war. And so, yeah, no, that brings up a lot of issues. You know what I mean?
Sorry, I was muted. Yeah, absolutely it does. I mean, you know, so there's so many issues here. Like, one is with sync, right? You can naturally take any tangent anywhere. But even aside from that, there's the idea that let's be real, people have fucking short attention spans. So it's like, I'm trying to work with not only boiling down a massive amount of information. So, like, there's, like, I'm trying to boil down my own mind's ability to run off on 30,000 tangents. But then, even if I simplify it, even the quasi-essential data is in itself is pretty, you know, weighty in the sense of, like, there's a lot of different aspects. You know, do I have to explain – how much do I need to explain? How much context do I need to give? So trying to boil that down to essentials and then feeling like people's attention spans are fucking shit. So how do I...
See, I wouldn't even care. I wouldn't even... Well, I guess you're trying to do this thing. I just sometimes, like, the people who can't have attention to that degree, then, like, that's...
That's their problem, right?
That's their problem, because all the people who can are going to be getting more out of it. But no, I think you're doing a great job, just to be clear. It's just, that was the one thing when I was watching it, I was like, oh, you're not mentioning that the day that we're doing this, the day and year that we're doing this, is the incident in Ferguson, and how that spiraled into this whole, you know, the resurgence of a race war idea. I mean, that still has gone on, but, like, that was, right, like, a big thing with the media, like, you know. And it's all coinciding at the same time, where they come out with Rosemary's Baby, the fucking miniseries, come out with an Aquarius, which is absolute rubbish. I can't watch it. The David Duchovny thing. It's just, like, it's the theme of the time again, and then it's what's happening in the media again. And so that's really weird.
Do you, I had this sort of thought while making this episode, that the fact, and this is going to sound, it doesn't matter how it sounds, I'm just going to say it. Just, it was a thought that I had of, so it took me a year to get here, but the timing of Obama going back into Iraq.
Right. Into Babylon, let's just say.
Well, that's how I did say it, but yeah. But right. That's making it more ritual. I'm just going to go political for a second.
Same thing, but go ahead.
that he's, you know, the man who's elected to end the war, quote unquote, does, he says he does. Then he goes back in, goes back on his word, and a day later, we have this national news story that consumes the media.
Yeah, yeah.
It's completely distract. It's again, it's the. It goes back to the scapegoat idea. You know, is Michael Brown sort of the, hey, not only is he the distraction, if you want to go ritualistic, then it could be the scapegoat. It could be the sacrifice.
Sure.
But if you want to go purely political and, you know, the Bernaysian sort of, will people really be distracted this easily? You know, can I draw your attention over here while I go do this thing that you would be really upset with me for otherwise?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and these things happen all the time, and it's always interesting which ones they choose to emphasize.
Right.
When they choose to emphasize them. They're like picking it out.
Well, precisely. So it's not that, like, I want to be clear here. I have immense sympathy for Michael Brown and the whole
oh, issue. Oh, yeah, let's be very clear about that.
Right. The whole issue around police brutality is a serious one. And,
right.
And on a racial level is a very serious one. But as you say, the fact that you can sort of pick and choose, like, here's the thing. You probably have a similar Facebook feed as I do. I'm friends with enough people and like enough pages that are politically sort of radical that I can see every day. Every day I see a different video of police brutality.
Sure.
Why do we get three a year that are national headlines?
Right, right. And then the school shooting thing that's super peculiar. And then it's like, and the timing of it was like, it's like, and then whenever there's like the big thing to emphasize with potential war or whatever, then we get these local issues like think locally, ignore the global or whatever, you know what I mean? It's like, and it's true. But at the same time, there's just this massive hypocrisy. It's like the big lie phenomenon that is so big, it's like too much to even acknowledge. You know that, like, I watched the end of Transcendence, you know, and they have this massive blackout, global blackout. And they're like, oh, global blackout. I was like, do you know what the fuck would happen if there was a global blackout? The fucking radiation poisoning would kill it. Like, it'd be so extreme, dude. Like, it takes at least a year to shut down a radiation, a power plant. And so it's just, you know. I don't remember exactly how that tied in. I mean, I had a purpose.
Is Transcendence the Johnny Depp uploading his consciousness to a computer movie?
Yeah, it's the extension of Dead Man. It's like the two of those are just absolutely resonant and complementary, like I was saying. But I don't know, it's just there's kind of like these I don't remember where I was going with that, sorry.
Yeah, that's all right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's go ritual for a minute. So as a it's Babylon.
Right.
They bring Manson, Aquarius, all this stuff back into it.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned before Golden Bough, talking about the sort of proxy killing. So it's almost like, again, the sacrifice, you know, is Michael Brown the sort of proxy sacrifice?
Right. Well, remember that Manson himself emphasizes Haiti and Malaysia in his mm-hmm. in his view. So he's in his own mythology that he's created beyond Helter Skelter. That's his deal, is he's just like, you know, ritual magic, not just like ritual you know, voodoo. And so, but then you have voodoo economics, you know what I mean? And like, it's like there's so much fucking, what you could call witchcraft happening with the CIA at that time, which is a lot of that is to do with paperclip and the fact that these people who were, so this is non, that's the weird thing. I mean, I'm sure you remember me talking about it, but that book, Proofs of a Conspiracy, that came out in the late 1700s, that basically shows the whole Illuminati movement and what it was. It documents the letters of Weisenhop with his people or whatever. But then they say, we'll reopen in 1 year under a different name when we get found out. Sure enough, 1 year after they get found out is the German Reading Societies, which sounds very innocent. You're like, German Reading Societies. But that was actually the people who took in Hitler. And so you have this connection in Germany where you're like, oh, well, these people got found out, went underground, reopened as a German Reading Society, took in Hitler, started world, you know, basically really started World War II on that end of it, you know, the whole Nazi movement. But then it's weird because those are the same people who got hired by the U.S. government to run NASA before, when it was a military organization, before it was quote unquote civilian. So it's like the follow-through of that is really crazy when it comes to American politics, because that was all occult. They had all these occult practices that they would do, that they would relate, like, oh, we're going to attack this place. What date are we going to attack it? Oh, what angle? How are we going to attack it? They'd use, like, pendulums and shit. You know, I mean, like, they had a whole occult philosophy behind the thing. I don't think that went away. I think that's been, like, inherent in our politics ever since. It's like there's so much of it is around witchcraft. And so that's what becomes really ironic with Manson, is that he's basically practicing witchcraft in a sense, getting charged with it by the very people who themselves are aspiring to accomplish the same witchcraft done in a different way, kind of different way, you know. But all the elements were there, so they, you know, they and all the elements are the golden bough. Go out to the wilderness. Go out to Death Valley. You're now an outsider. The only person that can, you know, make the kill and have the effect, that's the golden bough effect, is through the fool. So you have to have the outsider fool come in to the kingdom and kill a royal, and by doing so, you know, it has all these far-reaching effects. And so it's almost like that was desirous and all too convenient for the, you know, people who want to push for a war that isn't popular. You get them to focus on this. It's really like almost like simple reverse psychology in a way. It's just, it's got so many shells around it and so many complications around it. It's hard to see the forest from the trees and what's actually taking place in terms of that simplicity of the reversal, you know?
And as we said earlier, you know, do people even know they're playing into this? Like it's, you know, it's easy to speculate, oh, some grand Illuminati plan to, you know, kill Michael Brown for this reason or blah, blah, blah. But then it's just as possible also that it's literally like this event happens, which happens to encode the things.
Mm-hmm.
And they can either choose to take advantage of that or, you know, spin that story or play up that story or not. But it, or, you know, literally people could on their own take this issue and say, this will not stand, you know.
Right. It's just when it gets to the level, as Joel Alexander would say, my God, you know, it's like, it's really, there's cases where it just gets to that, like, my God level. And then you just got to be like, my God, you know. My God. It's so fucking out of control. It seems unreal. You know. Yeah. I keep coming back to that 666 days in both directions with Kubrick, and it's blowing my mind, man. That's fucking crazy. I don't know how that could possibly be.
Well, and yeah, does someone figure that out? You know, and plan that?
I don't know. You know that the thing with Ghost Rider from Roman Polanski? Have you seen it?
I've not seen it, no.
Okay, well, the whole point of I'm going to just major spoiler here is that the fucking person works for the CIA and it's encoded in a book using a style of encoding that's used frequently in Kabbalah. And so it's where you can either do it where it's the first word of a chapter, or you can do it where it's like the first line in verses or the first letter of verses. But basically you take sections of something and you add them up, and then you just take that first word and then of a chapter, and then you take the first word of the second chapter, and you can spell out sentences sometimes. But this is a case where it's encoding that the person worked for the CIA. And so, but what was tripping me out was that I'm relating it to, it's crazy to watch together. I've done it twice now with the Ninth Gate, with that film, because you're uncovering this gateway to hell. It's all witchcraft. And then on the other side of it, you have this guy trying to figure out the enigma of this book that's really relating to MK Ultra. So like, or whatever, CIA torture stuff, which is weird that Polanski would do two films on the same subject. Death and the Maiden is particularly MK Ultra. I mean, overtly. I mean, that's what it's about. And so you have basically Ben Kingsley plays this, you know, guy who's long in the past, he had tortured Sigourney Weaver's character, you know, and it ends up coming out, you know, that he in fact did this and with the CIA. And so he has these two CIA movies, and then he has these witchcraft movies, and he's like, CIA witchcraft, CIA witchcraft, you know, what is he trying to say? I mean, everyone should know that they were heavily steeped in the occult. To what end was it successful? Like, you know, there's reasonable questions there. You know, to what end was the CIA involved with the occult? How much of that related to what the Nazis practiced? You know what I mean? It's like, where's the line?
For sure. I mean, you know, even Rosemary's Baby, right? You have the same sort of decoding where she has the Scrabble letters, all of them witches.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. He plays on it, and then you have the tooth in The Tenant, you know, where he's uncovering this Egyptian mysticism influencing his life and mind controlling him to kill himself. That's the whole premise of the movie, is him being pulled to kill himself, and you don't know the line at which it's his own fantasy, it's his own projection, or if it's what's actually happening. I think it's pretty straightforward for me when I watch it that it seems to suggest that the woman who died in the room is looking for a resurrection. And so it's just her. But he's taking it as this whole huge conspiracy because she's literally manipulated his consciousness to relate to it as such to keep him from knowing his true, the true cause. He's actually relating to the person who wants something out of it as something to identify with. So he's literally like relating to his capture in a way, in a positive way, which is he wants to become her. And so he literally is becoming her. So she can take his place basically in this weird kind of way. But the point is that it's focusing on this whole unraveling of this, you know, enigma and then coming to the other side of it. And I find it really interesting that he'll go back and forth between CIA and witchcraft repeatedly. As if to suggest these are connected, you know.
Right.
And then for all the people in the world to be pointing that out, to have a Holocaust survivor who had his wife killed that had such an effect. I mean, people didn't lock their doors in LA before that happened. You know what I mean? Like, that ended that whole feel. Everyone got all tripped out, you know? And I've seen a miniature version of that here in Santa Cruz since the fucking crazy shit went down, you know, at the tannery. And so it's really unfortunate and sad. It was just, there's something to be said for that correlation. I think there's something to it. Politics and voodoo.
This is somewhat of a change here, but, you know, when we talk about our own, this is what makes it difficult for me. Like, I totally get your point, but so that's synchronized. You say, hey, you didn't even mention blah, blah, blah. I mean, like, so there's a lot of stuff that could have, more that could have gone in. And there's even a really sort of something that just hit me the other night. There's a line in there where the last line of the song is, her sofa's comfortable, but you will never know.
The knife was stuck in the side of the sofa, you know?
Yeah, right. I mean, she's literally the zebra rug that you know, comment on. I mean, that's, you know, I spent the other night, you know, looking at all the crime scene photos, trying to find a way that I could show the zebra rug in the most tasteful way that I could.
Yeah, you did a good job with that.
But, you know, that's literally, so there's her body is on the floor. She's not, when in the photos that I've, all the photos that I've seen, she's actually not on the zebra rug.
Right. She's right next to it, actually.
She's right next to it. So literally, she's sandwiched between the zebra. So she's on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
On one side of her is the zebra rug. And she's up against the sofa with the knife in it. Right. So she's literally between the sofa and the zebra rug. Right. You know, the idea that the last line would be, her sofa's comfortable, but you'll never – you know, I was just like, God damn, you know. But so I guess my question here is, unless there's some CIA agent shows up at the Olympia Sync Summit or whatever to put his voodoo on our shit. You know, I certainly didn't plan that. And I don't think anyone else did either. You know, how does that factor in to, you know, we're seeing the pattern and then attributing intentionality.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean that to be a contrarian. I mean that to ask genuinely, like, I some struggle with how do you make that distinction?
Yeah, well, I mean, for me, I just feel that there's – that everything's happening all at once and that there is a tendency towards this anyway and that it gets pushed. So it's like, you know how like a film reel back in the day – wouldn't spin unless if you pushed it. So like kind of it's like going in that direction, but it doesn't really get going until it gets that nudge. And so my feeling is that there's this tendency that exists on a certain level, but then it just gets pushed. And so yeah, I guess it's really strange, but then I also feel like that this shit is just happening anyway. And like, and just because if you see a synchronicity in something, a lot of that is what's being repressed in people. The event happened anyway, even without that. It's just that's the thing that's there in the midst of it that's almost like an undernetting of sorts. Like you can see the place where two things that shouldn't connect actually do connect. And yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's just like people are trying to behave as magicians, and they're affecting things in ways that they don't necessarily plan because there's so many different forces at work. I mean, come on, dude. It's fucking nuts. Sharon Tate's first film is about the Golden Bough, overtly. And the two titles of it are fucking 13 or Eye of the Devil. It went by both. Just like The Haunting of Julia could also be called Full Circle.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it's 13. That's her first film. That's her debut film. And she plays a witch. And then in her last film, it's supposed to be a comedy and there's nothing comical about it. It's called 12 plus 1. So this film,
right.
And which is her with the whole time with the fucking knife. The whole movie is just her opening up chairs looking for money with this knife. She's going around everywhere. And then fucking Orson Welles shows up and he's like, I'm Jack the Ripper, and runs around with this knife. And like, it's just so, in retrospect, after everything, it comes across as so dark and so fucking weird. And it's like, this is a comedy? This is a very dark comedy without even... in a very, like, kind of twist, like, back-ass way. Like, it's not, like, dark comedy, like, Very Bad Things, where you're like, oh, you can see it, but it's just there in the midst, you know? But the fact that it would be 13 and then 12 plus 1, and then in the film, the reason why they called Eye of the Devil 13 is because it's referring to the 12 disciples and then the 13th, and then they were like, we kill the 13th for the crops. So for their... they have vineyards and all this stuff. So in order for the crops to do well, they have to kill the guy. And so he knows he has a scheduled time to die. So he shows back up to be killed. And then he passes it on that his son is going to have to be killed years later in a ritual act. I mean, the film is about the Golden Bough. What the fuck? Like, really, right. What the fuck? And that goes beyond Polanski. That goes beyond these directors. It's like that's multiple directors would be involved in this whole... symbolic thing, like where you'd have to go with that. And but then you watch the film and it's like, dude, what the fuck? Like, it feels like it was very intentionally made. Like, it's like this movie had to be made for this purpose, you know. It's freaky in that way. If you want to see a very, very, very thorough analysis on Sharon Tate's films, you can look at the Patrick's blog. Come on, what is it? The fucking...
Blog of Caverns?
Blog of Caverns, thank you. So on his blog, he goes to town on looking at not just her films, but all of this. It's so complex. Yeah, I don't know. I really don't know. It's like you look at that guy who's got the fucking $1 trillion lawsuit, the filmmaker guy, you know, it's hard to take seriously, but... he's got a $1 trillion lawsuit against MSNBC and all this stuff, all this whole huge list of people. And you're like, oh, what would have to be involved in order for a conspiracy to go down like that, you know?
What guy are you talking about?
What's his name? I can't remember his name, but you know that there's a $1 trillion lawsuit against all the heads of media and government and all that for terrorizing the American people with a bullshit story. So he wants to take him to court.
Which bullshit story? There's
Sandy Hook.
Okay.
So he basically wants to take that particular case and prove in the court of law that there's just huge lies involved in really essential things to determine what happened, and that you know, it's like unprecedented, the degree of it. And so he's just like, you know, got a letter to the president and all this stuff. And like I said, in certain ways, it's hard to take seriously. But at the same time, it's like, no, this is a filed, you know, complaint. And so, you know, I mean, it's $1 trillion. It's $1 trillion lawsuit. Good luck with that, you know. But it is interesting that he's like, just what would have to be involved. He lists all the people that would be involved, and they're the heads of everything. It's like, people at the lower echelon of things don't even need to know if they're involved in something for it to work. That's just a realization that I keep having. It's like, you don't have to have everyone in the know and still have them contributing to it, you know?
Yeah, I absolutely get your point. You know, the lawsuit angle, I don't know how much that means, as you yourself pointed out, it's like, what does that actually count for? It's a damn good question.
Well, I mean, you know, those guys from the CIA were found guilty for killing Martin Luther King. That happened.
But that, right, but that was right. So that was a civil suit. So you know,
civil suit. Right.
Right. So the $1 trillion, he could get the $1 trillion, but no one would, you know, maybe no one goes to jail. Do you know what I mean?
Right. And then they continue to do whatever the fuck they're doing. But yeah, $1 trillion, that's a lot of money. And I'll tell you what, that would be a whole, like, to have that go to court at all, to have it legitimized that that could even happen. As it stands, that such a lie of that magnitude is so uncomprehendable to people, that it's, I mean, it's just, it, most people can't begin to process that could even happen. And so just to have people aware that that can, that they can be duped to that degree, that there's people that don't, that are greedy enough, you know, that they would go to those lengths. I'm not claiming that that happened with Sandy Hook. I happen to feel that there's strong evidence on the side of that, but I don't claim that with that one. But what I would claim is that giant things like that do happen and have happened. And just knowing that should be enough to make one question, you know. Just knowing that your history of, like, huge lies have been told and many lives have been lost due to those lies, that's kind of important. And conspiring groups, I mean, you've had how many times, you know? So that's interesting.
You mentioned before, right? Obviously, the big lie, you know, and there's the that sort of the Nazi is, you know, at this point, is that a Nazi adage or what? You know, the if you tell a lie big enough, people will believe it. You know,
it's in Mein Kampf.
Yeah,
and Hitler is saying it in regards to what he's saying about the Jews. So he's saying that the Jews are telling this huge lie, and that no one would believe it. But the irony is that he's telling huge lies with the fire. What's it called? The
Reichstag.
Yeah, Reichstag fire. And beyond that, but just like that is a staged. I mean, people actually died, and yet it's staged at the same time. And so you're like, who would tell that big of a lie? But he's the one saying these people are telling the huge lie, and then he himself is committing these huge lies. And so there you go. That's you know, that's how things work, I guess.
That's how it goes,
right? Yeah, well, I mean, that's playground logic too, you know. I mean, that's real basic shit. It's like, you get caught on the playground, what do, you know? I mean, it's literally that level of thinking, but it happens to work. We're like example, like, well, even beyond that, you know, that Crowley story with the tobacco.
Yeah.
Where he fucked the maid. And then he was like, he had planned ahead so that if he did get caught, he could tell his parents. So he went down to the tobacco place beforehand and told the guy there, if my parents ask if I went down here and got tobacco, you say yes. And so the guy's like, oh, you want me to tell on you if your parents ask? He's like, sure. And so he had sex with the maid, and then the maid told on him, and he said, no, I couldn't have done that because at that time I was out getting tobacco. And so, like, that kind of logic where you're like, oh, so they go and they check with the tobacco guy, and he's like, yeah, he was down here. And they're like, well, he wouldn't have said he did something wrong to cover it up.
Right.
Like,
right,
no,
right.
I was doing something right. And so you're like, he couldn't be that kind of, because he knew it was the lesser evil or the lesser thing of getting in trouble. And so they fire the maid. But it's like, that's that level of thinking is like what seems to go into a lot of these false flag events, you know, where it's just like, oh, well, you know, this is going to happen. And so we'll just divert, you know, it's that kind of logic, I guess, is all I'm saying.
I said, I see my own sort of blind spots or hesitancies You know, we talked about this a few episodes ago, and I was just talking. I was just talking about this last night, or the night before. I was talking to Melissa and discussing. I told you about that woman at my job whose daughter died,
Yeah.
and my wife said, like, she's like, "That's crazy." She's like, "If." She's like, if my child died, I would react. She, you know, like, and I didn't even let her finish the sentence. I'm like, no, you don't know how you'd react.
Right. Yeah, that's what I saw with Laura too. Yeah, you don't know how the fuck you're gonna. It's just so crazy. You don't know. It's unreal, is the thing.
Precisely.
It's just like it becomes this whole surreal experience where you're like, that can't be. It's like denial is the first stage, and it lasts for quite a bit off and on. It's like, no way. And like I kept on thinking I saw Maddie in front of my door because the girls would ride by on the scooters, and I think I just got so familiar with seeing Maddie ride by on her scooter that I cut every time a kid rides by, I'm like, oh, there's Matt. Like the whole thing was a dream. The whole thing was a night. I'm like, that didn't couldn't have really have happened. You know, it's just. And then I have to come back and be like, oh no. And so that creates a whole kind of. But at the same time, just to be clear, I've seen some incidents with that girl who got her whole family killed, and it's like she's there at the microphone just smiling. And I'm like, I'm sorry, dude. I mean, I know that it's hard for people to process and whatever, you know, and all this stuff. And people can act in all kinds of weird or awkward or not even. Like it doesn't faze them initially and all kinds of stuff, you know, but like it's really hard to take that girl seriously, you know, that this is something that actually happened. It just, you know which one I'm talking about?
I don't, but
It's the one where she puts up the fucking, what everyone says, the devil horns or whatever, you know, and she puts her hand up in the air with the, you know, thing, and she's all smiling, and her entire family was just killed. So she's now an only child. She's a child without siblings or parents. And then she's all hand up in the air with the devil sign, all smiling. Like, it's just like, what the fuck? And she's all talking about Harry Potter and shit. And it's like this inspirational speech. It just feels so fucking fake. You know, I can't help
So
it.
I'm gonna tell you a story, not for any other. I really like I loved the quote of yours that I pulled out for the synchronized, because it's like, to make a point is not to ne necessarily to negate another point. So I don't
Yeah.
say this as a contrary statement,
Sure.
but just as additional context, is where my mind goes. Is I remember I was in, I guess I was in high school. I was working as a stock boy in a supermarket. There was this girl who was a cashier at the supermarket. You know, whatever, we, you know, kind of flirty slash friend slash fooling around slash whatever, right? And her younger brother had some sort of terminal illness. I don't know. It's kind of fucked up, but I don't really remember the exact details of it. That was seems like a million years ago to me right now. And her little brother dies, and it was, you know, a pretty tragic thing for a young boy who died a pretty slow and miserable death. And she's young, he's young, and you know, basically all of us from the supermarket go to the funeral, right? We're gonna be there to support our friend, blah blah blah. I mean, and I remember she spent a good part of the funeral sort of in the back of the room with us, and granted, this is the back room, it's not up on a stage making a speech or anything, but and we all just joked around and laughed almost the whole time. And was that us trying to keep her from, you know, being sad? Was that her trying to not make us feel, you know, sometimes like all the weird psychology of like, oh, I don't want them to all be sitting here at this poor, at this miserable funeral, you know, or is it a solace? Are we changing the scene? Is when she goes home with her family, is she upset, you know? And I mean, like, she would occasionally stop laughing and sort of like you could see the reality sort of coming over her face, and like her entire expression would change into one of grief, and then kind of catch herself and come back to this very light-hearted thing. And it was almost like overcompensating. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure.
And I don't know. So I don't know the clip you're talking about, and I'm not trying to negate your point. It's just to say, like, you know, there's it's just like I don't like to the idea of this is how people would react to me is bad evidence, and I'm open to good evidence, you know, and that to me is not good evidence, because I don't think there is a norm of how to handle grief. And you could say, oh, there's the stages of grief, and there's, you know, it's like, sure, even that, though, it's when you're in the moment, when you're in a state of shock, or when you're trying to either trying to cope with it or trying to ignore it, or it hasn't quite hit you, or any of these things. You know, earlier I was talking to Wally about, and, you know, there's an obvious through line between our two conversations of, you know, Bernays and sort of mind control and stuff like that. We're talking about advertising and how much, how successful that's been and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, you and I have agree on the sort of CIA LSD tip of it didn't quite go the way they expected.
Yeah.
And I think part of that is underestimating the complexity of human psychology.
Mm-hmm.
And I would think with advertising or any of these, you know, efforts to mind control the populace or to pull a fast one on the populace, false flags, you know, you name it.
It has to start out with the assumption that people aren't going to dig too deep.
Oh, and I think it's successful, you know, and maybe that's just it. Maybe, you know, the Kit Kat Corporation is in business because enough people succumb to their advertising that they support their business, and the Republican Party stays in business because enough people fall for their nonsense. And, you know, it's like,
right.
You know, like I'm sitting here arguing for the complexity of human psychology, and maybe it's a numbers game. Maybe it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, if there's a sucker born every minute, there's enough minutes in a day to have enough suckers to keep you in power.
Right. Yeah, to keep you sucking. Yeah. reminds me of my favorite Crowley quote. I've never been able to get over the infantile belief that the universe was made for me to suck. Which whenever I say that, I get a flash of 2001 A Space Odyssey and Clockwork Orange, the two intros at the same time, where if you look at the planetary alignment as a giant tit, and then Alex is drinking the milk, you know, and it's like, yeah. Yeah, the universe made for me to suck. Yeah. I think I'm going to hop off the horn here. You know, I got this deadline with this book. I got 2 months now.
What's your deadline? Is the Beatles book?
Yeah.
Oh, are you going through with that? Yeah.
I'm trying to. The biggest challenge for it is knowing the order of things. Like, I got all these different avenues and rabbit holes and things that I can relate to, and I want to tie them in together into the points that are the subject matter. But I'm sure you're familiar with the difficulty of figuring out the order in which to place them. And so, yeah, I'm feeling like I'd just be better just to fucking just write it all. And then to figure out the order afterwards or something, you know. But yeah, you're a writer, you know, that kind of process, I guess. You know.
Am I a writer? I don't know what I am.
You're something like that. I read your books, so, you know, there's that.
I don't even know what the fuck I am anymore.
Right, well, I don't, you know, same here goes. But yeah, I was realizing that what I do, and I'm not alone in this, is gonzo synchromysticism. Because synchromysticism is one thing. Because with synchromysticism, we know the definition, right? Or at least the varying definitions, you know. I don't happen to resonate as much with Coates' definition as the mundane answer. I like the, you know, looking for connections that could have various implications, and, you know, not assuming for something to be mystical that it implies, you know, whatever. Anyways, Gonzo being journalism that you yourself are in, that you can't remove yourself from, which is, truth be told, just about all journalism, is that you have somebody is influencing it with their opinions that they have, almost no matter what. But Gonzo is more overt about it. It's just like, you're in the thing that you're looking at, and there's no escaping that. And so when I'm writing the thing and I look at the thing and I'm just like, okay, my birthday's fucking the day John Lennon died, a year to the day after John Lennon died, I'm in it, whether I like it or not. When you know it's your birthday comes on at the second side of the White Album, I can't help but be affected by that, because my fucking birthday is the day he died. So it has this whole kind of extra added imbuement.
Absolutely. You're making the same point I was trying to make earlier. I was saying, like, it's hard that sometimes I have a reluctance to attribute intentionality or ritual on someone else's behalf, because it's like, I know I'm in it and it's not intentional on my behalf.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't have to be mutually exclusive, obviously.
Right. They don't have to be mutually exclusive, exactly. And so that's what I'm trying to kind of just give myself permission to run with that after all the qualifying. So I started the thing out just kind of laying out. I mean, it might change, but as it stands, I'm just like, okay, I'm going to go into all this crazy shit. So just to be clear, this is where I'm coming from. All this shit that we go over and over and over here, which is essential, because all the times I get into these conversations with people and I have to requalify what it is that I'm actually communicating, it's really something. I feel as though I'm oftentimes just having the same conversation over and over and over again, because the circumstances literally require that in order to be able to make the points I want to make. And one of those was like saying affirming one thing doesn't negate another. It doesn't have to be that way. To make one point doesn't mean that this is your ultimate position, or everyone knows they've come across that position before, so they know. Oh, you're a conspiracy theorist. Oh, so you're a da-da-da-da-da, everything you fucking ever heard about conspiracy, all of a sudden that's you. And it's like, no, dude, I have a whole, you know.
Right, you believe in reptilians from planet Ike.
Or whatever the fuck they've come across. And even if it's not even something in particular, like, oh, I know the type. Precisely, or whatever. Yeah. And how many of us are actually even that type? Like, what does that even mean? Like, I don't even really know. I mean, every person is different. Everyone has their own assessment. Everybody, like, there's so much to, I don't know. It's just, that's really fascinating to me. And not just conspiracy, but in just so many different realms. It's the same fucking thing where you're like, when something gets said and it's like, oh, so you're saying that, blah, 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 blah. It's like, whoa, 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 whoa. Yeah, it's really something.
Yeah, it's a weird variation on a straw man argument. Because it's a fantasy, it's a projection, it's a hologram man argument. You know, it's like the straw man isn't even the thing that you're trying to put in place. It's the thing you don't even know you're putting in place. It's this pure projection of what you think the other person's saying.
Right. Yeah. It's really something. And it's like every little bit requires so much backstory. It's like you want to bring up a rabbit hole, and then there's almost like this demand sometimes where people are like, could you just explain this fucking rabbit hole to me in like a simple few sentences? You're like, okay, hold on. Let me try and do this here. Okay. It's like, could you just give me the cliff notes on this rabbit hole? In fact, give me the cliff notes of the cliff notes, and then maybe we can, you know. And I try over and over again, but things don't always work that way. It's like, oh, you know quantum physics. Oh, well, let's have a conversation about quantum physics. You know, it's like, well, let's go step by step here. It's like why Krishnamurti all the time is emphasizing, whoa, 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 slow down, slow down, slow down. It's like we can't have a true dialogue unless if we really slow down. And that's difficult to do sometimes. And I end up in trying to slow things down. Sometimes I'll ironically or paradoxically end up speeding it up.
Precisely.
Just like me, just like what I was just saying in replicating the conversation, I'm like, whoa, 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 whoa. But like, no, 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 no. And then by doing so, it encourages the other person to get even more defensive. Even though all your, you know, it's just fascinating. The same thing that goes into relationships goes into, you know, political debates, goes into fucking everything. It's like, it's just amazing to me how there could be so many different manifestations of the same phenomenon, I guess is all I'm really trying to communicate.
I'm with you, brother. It was the same thing I was trying to express about the synchronize, where it's like I'm trying to, you know, someone's asking you to make the rabbit hole accessible, and really all I'm trying to do is make something accessible, make it digestible, and it's like I'm putting in, you know, fucking like 80 hours worth of work and to get this video into a digestible format, and people are like, maybe I'll take a bite.
Right.
Yeah, you know, it's like, yep. I kind of know where you're going with this, or I have a feeling, you know.
Right. You don't know until you know. Yeah, you don't know until you've gone through it, yeah.
As long as she still has her friends. Oh no. Yeah. She doesn't care whether or not he's an island. They laugh, they make money. He's got a gold watch. She's got a silk dress and healthy breasts that bounce on his Italian leather sofa.
Thank you for listening to this broadcast from Syncbook Radio. If you enjoyed this episode, there's so much more content waiting for you at thesyncbook.com. Tune into our other Syncbook Radio programs, including 42 Minutes, Always Record, The Marty Leitz Mathematical Radio Hour, Pentimental, Synchronize, Sync Quick News, as well as our most recent editions, Fine Just Fine and Hypnosis. Our newest episodes are always free, and members get access to our full archive of over 600 hours. You'll find all of this, as well as our books and videos, at thesyncbook.com.
serrated edge that she moves back and forth. It's such a simple machine, she doesn't have to use force. When she gets what she wants, she puts the rest on a tray in a Ziploc bag. She's got a serrated edge that she moves back and forth. It's such a simple machine, she doesn't have to use force. When she gets what she wants, she puts the rest on a tray in a Ziploc bag in the freezer. Doesn't care whether or not he's an island. Oh, no. She doesn't care just as long as his ship's coming in. Alright, here it comes. Here it comes. She doesn't care whether or not he's an island. Oh, no. They laugh, they make money. He's got a gold watch, she's got a silk dress and healthy breasts that bounce on his Italian leather.